order at 1:30 p.m. Today's Wednesday, February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Members present, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Harriet Drummond, Representative Delana Johnson, our Vice Chair, Representative John Lincoln, Co-Chair, Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Tillinghast. Thank you. And is it Ben? Max. Thank you. Max, I'll get that. Thank you. Max Stanley, our LIO moderator. So thank you to both of you for your help today. If we could please ask members to turn off their cell phones. And what we're going to do today is do the presentations first. And I think with our limited time, want to make sure we get through both of the presentations because we have people here in town that will not be here in town later, and so really pleased to be able to have them here in person because that is such a nice just opportunity to have the face-to-face. So welcome to our guests from the Farm Bureau who are here today. We're going to hear from, and then, of course, Director Keyes is here and Deputy Commissioner Hansen. Thank you to both of you. So if Mr. Keyes would please come forward. What we'll do is the presentation from Division of Agriculture, then the presentation from the Farm Bureau, and then 217, because I think some of their presentation is going to help with that conversation. So thank you so much. And if you'd please put yourself on the record, and of course we'll do questions as we move through the slides at the end of each slide.
Hi, I am, for the record, I am Arthur Keyes, the Director of the Division of Agriculture for the Department of Natural Resources.
I'm Heidi Hansen, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Natural Resources.
I want to start off by saying thank you for this time, and it appears that everyone's eaten lunch, and that is a good thing because we're going to be talking about food, and I don't want to have everybody hungry while we're talking about food. So this is timing's great. So as you may have heard, or at least some of you, and not all of you, I'll just go over this briefly due to time constraints. I've been director for 2 years. Became director of agriculture on February 17th of 2016. My background, I'm a specialty crop farmer. That's my trade. And the specialty crops that I grow are onions, zucchini, and cucumbers. So vegetables, think your salad. That's my specialty. Now, when I tell people that I'm a specialty crop farmer, I get a lot of kind of blank stares. People wonder, what is a specialty crop? Isn't farming farming? Well, specialty crops are anything when you go into the grocery store and you walk into the produce department, pretty much everything there is a specialty crop. If it doesn't have to have a date stamped on it, it's probably a specialty crop. Because if it doesn't have a date on it, what that means is that it's going to expire naturally. It's a product that's a living product that's dying. So it's a specialty crop. That's an important definition. It's important, I think, that we make that distinction and that people understand that the food they eat, what it is, and where it comes from. I want to tell you all I'm here for the week until Friday, and so I look forward to any opportunity, or there will be opportunities. If anybody here would like to meet with me, please just reach out, and I will set up a time and come see you. And I also, this presentation wouldn't be doing it justice if I didn't invite you tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, at the Governor's Mansion, the People's House, for the third annual Alaska Grown reception. This is where, in 2016, where it was announced that I would be the Director of Agriculture. It's a historic event. I've spoken to farmers that have been here for 50 years in Alaska or longer, and they've never seen the kind of attention, you know, that an administration has ever paid to agriculture. This event, I think, it highlights that, and it's a source of hope for a lot of farmers in Alaska to see this kind of attention put on this industry that is such a rewarding and challenging at the same time. So, thank you. So our agenda today, we're going to talk about developing livestock industry, we're going to talk about Alaska's food security, and then we're going to talk very briefly about how you can support Alaska's agriculture industry. So I told you I'm a specialty crop farmer. That's my background. That's my experience. So I wanted you to hear directly from the farmers, their words, livestock producers, about their industry, the industry that they're so very proud of and that they're doing amazing things with. So here we have, if I can make this play, which I bet I can do, their words. Very short video. It's 2 minutes. So don't worry. It'll be over quickly.
Let's try that again. There's a volume.
Sound coming out of
yeah. Look in the other opposite corner on your screen. There was a little volume thing there, too. Oops, not. Yeah, okay, there we go. Take a brief at ease.
Gotcha. Testing, testing. Okay, I'll make sure I didn't blow everybody's eardrums out. So the livestock industry. Let's look at the numbers. So we know Alaskans are consuming roughly 156 million pounds of poultry, pork, and beef a year. We are producing, according to the USDA stats from 2016. Producing for consumption 1.75 million pounds of beef a year, roughly 750,000 pounds of pork. And then we jump over to poultry, and if you look closely there, you'll see that the numbers are for 2012. And so I had to like call USDA census people to find out what's going on here. Why do I have 2016 numbers on beef and pork, and I have 2012 on the poultry? Well, what it is that there's a agriculture census is done every 5 years, and that is it's a big deal. It's a huge deal. Every farmer in America is getting the census. If they don't fill it out, the census is going to call them. They're just going to keep pestering them until they get information. That is going to include everything across the board. That's going to include your poultry, beef, pork, every agriculture crop that's grown. The strawberries I used to grow are included in that. That's 5 years. But beef and pork are such a big deal in this country that they are surveyed every year. And that's why you're seeing beef and pork numbers from 2016 and poultry numbers from 2012. We expect to see the 2017 numbers later this year. What I think you're going to see on the poultry data is I think the numbers are just going to go, they're going to blow these out of the water. That's my belief. In 2016, we know the import numbers for poultry because they have to get an import permit to import them. They imported over 120,000 birds. The previous year, it was between 30 and 40,000. So the growth is there in this industry. On the dairy side of things, as of 2017, this summer, we're down to one dairy in Alaska. This should concern everybody here. It's an important part of the industry, and unfortunately, we're down to one, and Alaskans are consuming roughly 32 million pounds of milk a year, and when we had two dairies in 2016, you can see we produced 3.5 million pounds. So, again, an opportunity. We have an opportunity with the protein production, the pork, the poultry, and the cattle, of a 153 million pound opportunity. I mean, that's mind-boggling to me. The milk opportunity, we're producing just a fraction of what's consumed here. So, again, more opportunities for that. Now, the trends. I like this trends one. This one's fun if I present it right. So what you see here is the trends going up. The number of farms from 1992 to 2012 has increased. 92 showing 500 farms, 2012, 762. And again, I think the new ag data that we have later this year is going to show more, I believe it will show more increases. So we look at 92's livestock production numbers or livestock value of sold in 1992. We're looking at roughly $5 million. And then what's interesting, though, is you look at the crop number, and it's roughly $10 million, give or take. Well, if you come to 2012, those numbers are inverting. They're starting to change. And so, you know, wondering what's going on here with this. And the best explanation that I believe what's happening, and this is a personal belief. It's not based on a survey. It's just watching this. It's based on anecdotal information of heading to Delta Junction, meeting with these farmers, and talking to them about what's going on in the industry. I believe that the number of farms has increased because the interest in local food has increased. The interest in food security has increased, and so the number of farmers has increased with that. As they have increased, they've brought more livestock online. As the livestock numbers have increased, I believe that the livestock are a cornerstone to the agriculture industry. And what I mean by that is that the more animals you bring into Alaska, the more grain you need to feed them and the more hay you need for them. And so what happens is the production on these other supporting industries is rising with it. That's what I believe is happening. So livestock. I mean, earlier, Representative Johnson, you made the comment, you know, about support at the PMC. I think these stats right here are showing you, in my opinion, a justification for actually starting to support this industry in ways that they support it in every other state in the union. So, moving on.
Yeah. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Keyes, the reason we don't have numbers beyond 2012 is because of the five-year agriculture census that the numbers haven't been produced yet.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, that is correct. Those numbers will be they should be public information here later this year.
So the census was done in 2017, and is it the U.S. Department of Agriculture is compiling this data?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond. So the 2017 census is happening right now. I believe it wraps up fairly soon, and they're going to start calling the producers. They needed the 2017 season to end before they did the census. And, so they're working on compiling that. And if you can imagine the monumental amount of information that they're collecting and the effort they're having to put into it, because I'll tell you something, farmers, they don't like filling out this paperwork. And so it's the USDA. Yeah, it's the USDA that does this huge task.
We can send a drone to take a look. If they don't want to fill out the paperwork, we can take pictures of it. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Keyes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one question. Could you define what a farm is? I mean, for accounting. On your slide.
For accounting. Through the chair, Representative Johnson. So a farm, I am not sure the exact number of sales you have to have. It might be as little as 1,000. It could even be a little bit less than that. But you have to have some sales, generated some sales income, and be able to show that, or you know, tell the USDA, hey, I generated some sales, and then you can be included in the census. Okay. That's my understanding.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you want additional information on that?
No, I just was looking at the slide and wanted to clarify what a farm is for the record.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that Juneau used to have a dairy farm back in the day. Of these farms, what would you say is their approximate breakdown geographically?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, that's a great question, anything I say on that is going to be it would be a guess, and or just a pure speculation. I think that geographically in the state, you have two, maybe even three, growing sections that are areas that are traditionally considered where your agriculture is centered. You know, Kenai Peninsula, Matanuska Valley, and then north of the range, Delta Junction, Fairbanks area. And then I think we've seen a pretty good example, and I'll touch on this a little bit later, that we have farms all over the state. They're everywhere. There's farmers markets everywhere. I will touch on that just a little bit later. But where are they all located? You have a core, and then I think you've got some outliers.
Rep. Parrish, through the chair, if we could get back to you, we'd be happy to give you more specifics.
Thank you. Thanks.
Please continue.
So let's talk about some of the history here. So since 1981, there has been no positions in the Alaska Division of Agriculture with the expertise necessary and solely committed to developing the livestock industry and supporting it. Like I said earlier, there's 156 million pounds opportunity, or consumption that's happening in Alaska, and there's a roughly 2.5 million pounds are actually being produced here a year, roughly. So 153 million pound opportunity, excuse me. We're producing roughly 1.5 to 1.6% of all that's consumed. So there's a huge opportunity, and there hasn't been support for decades. I do want to point out that at the Division of Agriculture, we do have programs that we've had for quite a while, and some of them 4 decades, that do support the livestock industry in ways that are not, nutrition, that don't have the science behind them. We have land sales, as you can see. We have loans. We have, retail. We help with retail access. We help with farmers markets. We do help and provide some support. But as far as, like, the key scientific veterinary knowledge, we don't have it. We do not have it. This livestock section that's been proposed, it consists of two positions, as you've heard, a veterinarian and then a development specialist to support the veterinarian, provide the non-scientific side of the work that needs to happen. So I envision that this staff will meet the producers, collaborate with the private sector veterinarians, work with USDA, work with the extension, work with the university, work with the stakeholders to provide the support for the continued development of this industry, and to provide a conduit to current, reliable, updated information. And I also want to say to advocate for this industry. And I think that's important. I think there's a need for that. I think there's a need for someone with the scientific knowledge to be there to advocate for this industry. I was in a meeting with the national ag directors, and I did speak to veterinarians from other states, and that is, this advocacy component that I talk about. I mean, it may not seem like a big deal, but there's a scientific base of knowledge there that if you don't have, you don't have. They were talking about some of the diseases and the issues that are facing the livestock industry nationally and internationally, and I certainly don't speak that language, and I don't think you would be able to without that education base. So,
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where will the positions be located, and to what extent do you expect them to travel and support other opportunities, say, in caribou herding or poultry raising?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish. That's a great question. Right now, I think they would most likely house them at the Palmer main office. On the caribou side of things, you do have two fish and wildlife veterinarians that I think that really meet that need already, and we wouldn't be looking to, you know, take any duties away from them. I think they've got that, you know, under control. The poultry side of things, absolutely. That's one of the things that is a tremendous opportunity. Poultry is, from the life cycle of a bird, poultry is a low-hanging fruit. I mean, you bring a bird in, and within, you know, a couple months, you've got a marketable product. It's just an incredibly fast turnaround time. So, yeah, that would be a component of what this veterinarian we would expect them to do.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Drummond.
Representative Parrish talked about caribou. But isn't there a difference between a caribou and a reindeer? And don't we have some reindeer farms in the state that would be considered part of the livestock industry as opposed to part of the wildlife under the other department?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, yes, they are different. They are not the same animal. I think they look similar. However, when you talk to someone, a hunter or someone that's in the know, they will tell you that they are distinctly different animals. They have a different, I think, different thought processes, and they look a little bit different, too, to people that understand this. Unfortunately, one of the deficiencies that the Division of Ag has had since 1981 is this livestock capacity, and our involvement with the reindeer, the herding that is going on, is not there. It doesn't exist. So to answer questions about, you know, what's out there is right now, currently, really outside of my purview.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
And so the veterinarian position that is moving to the Division of Agriculture, will that assist in bringing in the reindeer herding to be further assisted by the department?
So through the chair, Representative Drummond, to be clear, we're not actually going to move a veterinarian into the division. We're going to reclassify a vacant position. I think that's a very important distinction to make. And as far as assisting the reindeer, I think, you know, earlier I mentioned that the collaboration with the Department of Environmental Conservation's veterinarian, it's important. It's important that collaboration happens. Mm-hmm. And I believe that having a veterinarian in agriculture would increase the capacity, you know, the ability of the state to meet the needs of the industry. And I don't know that I could answer that right now. You know, I think we would have to, I would move forward with the program and see where that collaboration takes us and see how the program develops.
Next year, perhaps.
Perhaps next year.
Have a better answer.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond. Yeah, perhaps next year I would have a better, more comprehensive answer.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Keyes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, please continue.
As you heard me mention before, we have hosted livestock meetings at the Division of Agriculture, and based on the input, one of the things that we heard over and over again, at least I certainly heard it, was people want a one-stop shop. The producers want a place where they can go, and they can ask questions about animal feed, they can ask health questions, they can ask how do I import. They want to know, there's a lot of information, there's a lot of moving parts and pieces to this, and the producers would like that. Herd health was another issue that was brought up. Nutritional requirements. You know, if you imagine, you know, we're producing animals here where it's 40 below or maybe even colder. Can you imagine how unique those nutritional requirements are for those animals versus what, the huge cattle ranch on Hawaii has to face? Completely different. And so, you know, one of the things that happens, I get emails all the time saying, hey, I'd like to come to Alaska and be a cattle farmer. And they ask me questions about it, and, you know, I can point them in the direction of what it takes to get land. I can talk to them about getting a loan, but I can't. I don't have the capacity to tell them what, any much more than that about raising livestock and what they want to do. So We have, you know, these are the two positions, the veterinarian and then the development specialist. The veterinarian is going to bring the science background to this. And then the development specialist brings the, you know, the other side of things that's not science. That's, well, you know, there's going to be a lot to do. And I imagine they would both be very busy. So this is a fun slide. This talks about, you know, wish lists. What would you like to see happen? And, you know, everything I've talked about before, you know, where we're at, what we produce, what we consume, and I'd like to see production double in 2 years. Wouldn't that be cool? If I came back here in 2 years and said, hey, production doubled, wouldn't that be amazing? Well, it just might be doable. And so that's what I'd like to see happen. And you can see, you know, we just graphed it out. Let's just talk. 2028, where we could be. Well, I'm going to focus on the two-year dream because I one bite at a time. Let's focus on, you know, as much as we think we can handle. We'll focus on a two-year dream. I'd like to see it double. So,
Representative Lincoln has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just how much of that increase could be attributed to current farms or programs expanding versus needing new ones?
Through the chair, Representative Lincoln, do you mean
to double the production? Would it be existing livestock operations expanding there, or would you need to introduce new ones?
Perfect. Now I understand. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Lincoln. Yeah, I think you have some. I think there's some producers right now that intend to increase their production. Hear that anecdotally. It's not their business plan that they're sharing, but they are sharing their excitement with me. I do think that there's more opportunity. I think it's a great time to be a farmer in Alaska, so I think there will be new farmers coming on board. And I think that the existing farmers, I think the opportunity to ramp up and produce more is there. I think the growth opportunities on the small scale and big scale will naturally emerge.
Any follow-up? Please continue. And just looking at time, it may be in the next 10 to 15 minutes, if we can, wrap up with yours to bring up the Farm Bureau.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I will expedite. Next slide. So this slide here, we're going to talk about food. We're going to switch topics and go to food security. 92 to 98% of our food is imported. Every Alaskan is dependent on the next barge, train, boat, or truck for their next meal. Alaska grown food is sweeter, it's fresher, it's healthier, and this is important, it can be grown in every community in Alaska. That cannot be understated. It can be done everywhere. And it's an economic opportunity. I really hadn't thought about talking about that, but it's also an economic opportunity wherever people are eating.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great to have you back again. And I was there at the Alaska Food Program at the governor's home last year, and that was great. On food access, you have on the slide up here. We talk about affordability. One of the concerns I have with the legislation is it actually increases the surcharge, if you will, or the spread between what a municipality or a school district would pay for Alaska grown food. I think it goes from 7% to 15, up to 15%. And, you know, it strikes me that affordability is a key here, is that, you know, if it's locally grown, you're not shipping it up, you have none of those costs. And I was wondering if you could speak to why it's necessary, if you have something that's grown basically in our backyard, why that 7 to 15%, you know, in tight budget times when we're basically cranking on the on school districts to, you know, sharpen their pencil and figure out how to spend smarter. Why is that 7 to 15% necessary, or do you see it as necessary to, you know, kind of augment Alaska grown through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that's a great question. Let me use milk as an example. You can go to the grocery store and you can buy a gallon of milk, outside milk, for less than $4. Or you can go to the grocery store in the Matanuska Valley, Anchorage, and you can buy a local gallon of milk for $5.50, a little bit more, you know, $1.50 more maybe for that milk. Something like that. Well, here's the challenge that I would tell anybody. Take that outside milk and ship it back where it came. Do it for $3.50. Can't do it. It is being subsidized. It is being subsidized to the detriment of the local industry that's here. That's one example. I think there are other examples of we are Alaskan producers are producing a healthier, better, fresher product, but they, in some cases, are competing with a product that it's not a level playing field. It's not a level playing field with how it's being, how the business model's being done for getting it up here. Alaska, historically, since the 1940s, and I just got a book on this, has been known as a dumping ground for product getting up here. It's not a level playing field. That's the best, shortest, briefest answer I can give you, I think.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say the milk that I had as a kid in the Brooks Range in the 50s and 60s came in a red and white box, and you mixed it with water. And so, I mean, I think anything. I mean, I agree with you. I think the local stuff is good, but I am challenged with the idea of supplement, hanging basically a 15% surcharge on something that arguably should be locally produced and be more inexpensive notwithstanding the freshness aspect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I follow?
Sure.
Through the chair, Representative Birch. One of the successes we've seen to farm to school, for example, and certainly it's not a 15% different, but the Anchorage School District, they make it's one of the largest kitchens in the state, and they make over 30,000 meals a day for the children, and they've got a very innovative and forward-thinking foods manager that they brought in fairly recently, and one of the things that they were doing is they were using powdered potatoes, dried potatoes flakes, to make their mashed potatoes. And so they started working with our staff at the farm school program, and they tried local potatoes. So they can serve a fresh local potato for 1.4 cents more than serving flaked dried potatoes to the kids. So not everything is going to be 15%, but so there's examples of efficiencies there. I think the 15% in some cases it might make the difference. I made a comment earlier that you could produce food in every single community in Alaska. Well, in some of these communities, it is going to be expensive to produce it there. It's still going to be better for you. It's going to be fresher. It's going to be better for the community, and it's going to create local jobs. And for example, the indoor hydroponic growing that's happening in some of these bush communities, I think that's a really good thing. And so maybe there's a cost differential there. Maybe the health benefits, though, might help offset some of that and make it more palatable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
All right, thank you. When I was first introduced to farmers markets, there were 13. Currently, there are over 40. We have the most innovative producers in the world here in Alaska. We are using indoor growing systems, hydroponic. We are using high tunnels to extend the season. They're all over the state. And now, in the South Central, we have our very first mobile farmers market that is traveling from Valdez to Homer. We have the potential for a farmers market in every community in Alaska. I said that earlier. That's what this slide's about. High tunnels, innovative methods. We can feed people in every community in Alaska. Food security and access. If every Alaskan, and I know everyone's heard this before. I know I've said it before in this room, so I think everyone's heard it before. If every Alaskan spent $5 a week on Alaska-grown food, it would put $188 million into the local economy. This is less than 1% of the money Alaskans spend on food annually. The Division of Ag is working very hard to connect farmers with the retail outlets to pursue that 99%. Alaskans, as seen in national trends, are not eating enough fruits and vegetables. One of the things, if you look at the stat right here, the number of high school students in Alaska meeting the recommended consumption of fruits and vegetables is roughly 10%. Imagine that. Imagine this is what keeps you healthy. This is the basis of your life, and you're eating 10% of the foods that are necessary to have a healthy life. And one of the things we have had tremendous success with is getting fresh Alaskan products into the school lunches. I mentioned the Anchorage School District. I think Johanna mentioned some other school districts. And, you know, we believe that the models that are happening in these schools that are successfully doing this, I think they can be replicated. We believe that they can be replicated throughout the state, as just as Anchorage School District is doing it. Not only are we finding cost savings using Alaska-grown products, we are seeing better food options for our kids. And how you can get involved. You can get involved by participating in the Alaska-grown $5 challenge. Visit a local farmer. Ask for Alaska-grown at the restaurant. Visit a farm, an orchard, a greenhouse, or a garden. Join our Alaska-grown Facebook page. We have 57,000 followers on that. We have the second or third largest following of any marketing program in the nation, Alaska-grown. We're one of the oldest. This past year, the five-month $5 challenge was launched June 1st through October 31st. 40 retail outlets participated. The grower feedback was positive. We had growers telling us that the complaint that they had about this five-month $5 challenge was that they didn't know about it in January. We didn't either. We hadn't created it. We hadn't started this program. We hadn't started doing what we did. And their complaint was that they're selling out. We didn't tell them enough times so that they could plant enough crops to feed them. So it's an exciting success. It's something that I am very proud of, and I will be, for the remainder of my tenure here. Farmers markets all over the state engaged the program. Next year we have farms telling us they're going to expand production, and I personally, this is my personal opinion, I believe you're going to see a greater variety of Alaska-grown products in the grocery stores. It's coming fast, isn't it? I believe you'll see a greater variety this summer in the grocery stores because of the engagement that's happening. And then I'm going to wrap this up and let everybody go, but I have to tell you again, please don't forget about the reception tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the governor's house. I'm looking forward to seeing everybody there if you can make it, and it's going to be fun. It's going to be some great food, and anyway, just fantastic. So this photo that you're going to look at here, I need to mention that this is the winning store of our $5 challenge. And what you can see there, this is the local Carr's Safeway store in Palmer. This produce manager went out to a local farmer, collected the soil. He filled that little concrete brick area right there with soil. He dug the crops out of the field, and he planted them in the grocery store. Behind that, you'll see the two tents. He created a mini farmer's market. And when he did it, he called us up and told us he was doing it. I went over to the store and looked at it, and it was amazing to be there and watch the customers come through the front door and stop, get their phones out, and take pictures of the display. So amazing stuff. This is produce manager and store manager. They're going to be at the governor's reception tomorrow night, and I'd love to introduce them to you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Couple of questions before you go. Representative Birch.
Just a quick, you mentioned something about specialty crops don't have an expiration date, and I'm curious about expiration dates because I had to get sent to the store and I'm advised to pick something up. I'm supposed to look at the date, right? What stuff has a date and what doesn't?
Through the chair, Representative Birch. So basically, the produce department, that you have apples and oranges and potatoes, and those things are going to go bad. They're going to expire on their own. They don't need someone to stamp a date on them to tell you when they're going to go bad. It's going to be self-evident because they're a living, my opinion, they're a living thing. They're good for you. They're healthy for you. And that's why I'm a huge proponent of specialty crops. So that's what I meant by not a date.
Okay. And then follow up, where does the, we've got a hemp bill coming up. Where does the marijuana thing fit into Alaska grown? A lot of discussion, is that in your world or is that in another world?
Through the chair, Representative, thank you for that question. The marijuana is currently in a different world. It is overseen by the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board. Hemp is, for the sake of this conversation and the pending legislation, it'll be a crop. and that will be in my world.
Okay.
And we would like to make a clear distinction between hemp and marijuana, and sometimes maybe there's not a clear distinction, so that's making this a very fun experience.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lincoln, and then Drummond, and then we'll have our Farm Bureau friends come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't want to take more time on this topic today, but I definitely want to learn more about these subsidies that are undercutting Alaskan products. So if there's some reading material or something you could provide, I'd appreciate that.
Through the Chair, Representative Lincoln, maybe I could come and speak with you?
Yeah, sounds good.
I would love to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it's all right to mention that I'm carrying the bill for industrial hemp that has come over from the Senate in the House, and it defines the maximum allowable THC, which is the psychoactive molecule in marijuana, so that hemp is not psychoactive. And it will be very interesting when we get to that point. Thank you very much.
Yes. Oh, Representative Tallarico.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just want to squeeze in one comment. And I appreciate the information that's in this. This is just a suggestion, but on page 9 you have a graph about your goals, which I think it's great that we have those goals. Back on page 4 we actually have the numbers. Is there any chance that you could tie those volumes, weights, or numbers, or whatever you do, in a right-hand vertical column so that we could kind of tie the percentages together with the actual volume that you're talking about? You know what I mean? I think that would really complete your graph for you and help people with a target.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Tallarico, thank you.
Okay, and if you'll share that, then we'll share that with the committee. Okay. So don't go too far in case there are additional questions, and hopefully you'll be here when we get to the bill.
I will sit right there.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your great presentation. And if we could please invite, I think it's Amy and Bryce are going to do the presentation from the Farm Bureau. We also want to do a special welcome. If you noticed as we were waiting, because I think it's when their plane arrived and they were able to drop off their luggage and get here, but we have guests from the Alaska Future Farmers Association. So thank you for joining us and welcome. Hopefully we're going to do some things that make it easier for you to get into this industry. And want to also recognize Kevin Fox, who's their advisor for the Alaska State. There you are. Hi. Nice to see you. Thank you for joining us. Everyone should have the presentation with the front page that says Alaska Farm Bureau on the presentation, and if you don't, please let us know and we'll get a copy to you. Just take a brief at ease. Little technical thing there. Glad we're set up. And please welcome and put yourselves on the record. And we're great to it's going to be great to have your presentation.
Yes, and thank you, Co-Chair Tarr and Josephson. For the record, my name is Amy Seitz. I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Bureau. And I'm here with Bryce Wrigley, who is the President of the Alaska Farm Bureau. And as always, we're excited to talk about agriculture and farming in Alaska. And for those of you who maybe don't know what the Farm Bureau is, we're the largest agriculture advocacy organization in Alaska. We have almost 400 members now. And one of our major focuses is promoting policy that will help us expand the agriculture industry in Alaska. Having a good policy in place will help build our farms, which in turn will improve our food security, which I know is a big issue that we've been talking about, and also stabilize our local economies. And being a grassroots organization means that our members, our farmer members, drive the ship for us. They decide what the major issues are, they decide what we need to focus on, and they decide what our priorities are from year to year. So the Farm Bureau's mission is to improve the economic well-being and expansion of agriculture and to enrich the quality of life for all Alaskans. Having policies in place that allow our farmers and ranchers to grow, educating consumers on how they can support Alaskan agriculture, and securing the future of farms through things like making sure we have land that's accessible to farming, or getting our youth involved, like our FFA youth back here, so we make sure we have farmers in the future. These are the key points on how we fulfill our mission. Alaskans are currently only producing about 5% of the food that we consume, and I think Director Keyes pointed on that in his presentation. We're very dependent on shipping and transportation, and as we know, we have natural disasters or mechanical problems. And when an earthquake or an avalanche or a barge breaks down, we notice at the grocery stores that we don't have a long-term supply of food on the shelves. It's about a 3 to 5 day supply for most food items. And without successful farms and ranches, we will continue to depend on the food imports and be reliant on the shipping industry. Now, I do want to point out, when we talk about farming, most of us focus on food. But here in Alaska and everywhere in the world, farming isn't just food, and we have different sectors that do contribute to the local economies. Our natural fiber producers, you know, we have wool, cashmere, angora, kivyut, and we have a new wool mill up in Fairbanks that is operating, which will help expand that sector. Our blossoming peony industry, that if you don't know very much about it, we do have several of our peony growers with us here, and that is a pretty fascinating story on the peony growers. And then we also have things like rhodiola, which is, you know, it can be a food item or tea, but also it's a medicinal crop. So we do have more than just food. But improving and expanding the agriculture industry does enrich the life for Alaskans through food security and sustainable local economies.
So for the record, my name is Bryce Wrigley. I'm president of the Alaska Farm Bureau. I'm very pleased to be here. And more importantly than that, I, along with hundreds of other Alaskan farmers, grow the food that you guys eat. That's an important thing to keep in mind. When we talk about food security is has been a mission, a priority for the Alaska Farm Bureau for, I think, about 10 or 11 years. And we've launched a number of initiatives, beginning with the Alaska Food Independence Project, and that morphed into the Alaska Food Policy Council. We have been aggressively pursuing opportunities, policies, progress in the ag-related and production-related arena of agriculture for a long time. Our goal is ultimately to be able to feed Alaska a balanced diet for a period of about 90 days in the case of an emergency. Why do we pick 90 days? Because that's what CDC says, the time of a quarantine, if there was ever a quarantine in America that restricted the ability to transport food, then that would those quarantines can go up to 90 days. Beyond that, there are other reasons for a 90-day goal, and that would represent in terms of a goal to achieve about 25% of a year's supply. Now, we're not proposing to raise oranges and bananas and things like that, but rather a balanced diet. So that would include things like meat, grains, dairy, fruits and vegetables. That food needs to become part of our distribution chain, just part of the grocery store. It doesn't have to be warehoused. It doesn't have to be rotated. It doesn't have to be tucked away someplace and monitored, because it's part of the natural distribution and ebb and flow of commerce as people come into the grocery stores, which is another reason to put it in the distribution chain, is so that it's where people shop. So they see it and they begin to look for it, and then when other foods may not be available or may not be as available, then they're already familiar with those things.
Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes when we think about food security, we think about the lower 48 and Alaska as this, you know, separate spot. But there's
countries.
Separate country, yes. Yes, I think of that often. But then once you get things to Alaska, into South Central, say, whatever the distribution point is, I mean, we have all these other locations that are as far away as the lower 48 even. So do we, as within Alaska have talk about food security? Well, say like Nome or somewhere like that, where they do we have any policy around food security within Alaska? You know where I'm trying to get to here. Without I'm trying to have a hard time articulating it, but there's a part about getting it to Alaska as a whole, and there's a part of having places in other parts of the state that we have to be aware of, which seems to me as a state legislator we should definitely be paying attention to.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I agree with that assessment, and that is certainly part of the discussion that needs to happen. To my knowledge, we haven't had that particular discussion except in terms of broad terms of community emergency planning and things like that. However, one aspect to keep in mind is that if the food is grown here, it's immediately 1,800 miles closer than it was before, and then distribution can be worked out. One of the challenges that we face when we talk about a disaster is it doesn't have to happen in Alaska. Because our food is sourced in someplace else, it could happen there. It could be a dock worker strike. It could be an outbreak of flu. It could be something. It could be an earthquake off the Pacific Northwest that wrecked some of the infrastructure for the ports. It doesn't even have to happen in Alaska to affect us. And so that's why it's important for us to grow a percentage of our food here so that it is available, so it is close. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
And I will say that on Monday, March 5th, I think I have the date right, we're going to actually be having that conversation about a statewide policy. And so stay tuned for that. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wrigley and Ms. Seitz, for the presentation so far. You mentioned assuring that locally grown vegetables and other products are available in supermarkets where people shop. I noticed that I'm a big Costco shopper, and I noticed that Costco, at least in Anchorage, has locally produced sausage, hot dogs, processed salmon, locally processed salmon. And when I've been to Costco's in other parts of the country, they also try to source local products, but obviously they don't ship them from Alaska to their other stores. But there's a further story on that one. But I wonder if you know, I have not seen vegetables from Alaska in our Costco stores. Do you know anything about that and how that might come to pass?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Drummond. I'm actually not a vegetable grower, but I understand the system, especially in a large chain store, and that is that generally they work through a distributor, mm-hmm. and with our own products, we've learned the value. We began going out and taking them. We'd drive them to the store, and I mean, we were the little red hen. We were growing it, we were making it, we were hauling it, we were doing everything except for preparing and spoon feeding it, and we did a little bit of that. However. When we got to a certain point in our production and in our sourcing, in fact, it happened when Arthur mentioned the $5 challenge last year. That opened the Safeway market to our products, and not just Safeway in Fairbanks or in Anchorage, but it opened 23 Safeway stores to our products. I mean, it was huge for us. When that happened, we had to go through a distributor. There was no way we could make all those trips. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about Costco and carrying vegetables, certain stores may have a local policy that they're allowed to source a certain amount of stuff locally on a different account. But generally, they work through a distributor. A distributor forms a relationship with a store. And then once you get into the distributor, then they can go pitch that stuff to another store.
Thank you.
And if I could add through the chair, Representative Drummond, I believe Costco has expressed an interest in starting to get more local products. So at least we're moving that way.
Good, especially if they're planning to open a store in Fairbanks now, too. That's going to put them more statewide. And, of course, there's one here in Juneau, which is probably the smallest Costco I've ever been to in the United States. Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, so the point is you don't really have to, we don't have to have a warehouse because the farms, the bin, the grain bins, the dairy herds, the feedlots, the hog barns, the potato sheds, these become essentially a storage vessel. It becomes part of our storage system, and it's always growing, and it's always rotating, and it just becomes part of the system like it does in America. So what would it really take to I should probably mention, let's go back to that slide. I should probably mention, we typically hear about fruits and vegetables. We potatoes particularly. We hear about a little bit of meat, a little bit of milk. But it's important to note that in the food pyramid, we can raise something from all of those areas, all of those parts of the food pyramid. And so this slide actually highlights some of those specific products that can be raised here. And that's why I say we can produce a balanced diet. It may not be the same things that you're used to going to the store and buying, but it will provide the nutritional benefits, it will provide the fiber, it'll provide the fats, it'll provide the vegetables, minerals and vitamins that it requires to sustain life and do it healthily. And so that's an important distinction to add. So how much do we really need? What does it take to achieve the goal of a chicken in every pot, so to speak, for Alaska? This slide represents, as you can see, a 90-day supply would take approximately 1,200 acres of spuds. This is based on average consumption in America. 1,200 acres. We're currently producing around between 450 and 550 acres a year. Some products like spuds and carrots, we're well on our way to raising enough to feed Alaska for a 90-day term. Other types of food were not quite so good, but we're making progress. I think what I have noticed is that there is an increased as the market is growing and opening, farmers are expanding and are willing to expand. That has to happen simultaneously, but something has to get started. It's kind of this classic chicken and the egg syndrome. Once you have a market, there's a vacuum created that will be filled. It will be filled either by bringing it in from outside, or it'll be filled from somebody growing it here. And so, if we create the climate and the opportunity to grow it here, then farmers will respond. We grow in some challenging conditions. I mean, and yet we do it. There are farmers growing food in Antarctica. Farmers are like bacteria. They grow everywhere, and they produce everywhere. You can't stop them. And all that is needed is the right opportunity, and then they will perform. One of the most important functions that Alaska Farm Bureau does is to advocate for policies that help farmers put food on your plate. And legislators, administration, and farmers need to work together on these policies so that they assist agriculture in Alaska to grow. Other states have had hundreds of years to develop their agriculture system, their processing capacity, and over the years as they have been there and existed and grown, new rules and laws have been added in and implemented, and so it was basically a minor change here, and a few years later another minor change here, and then they were able to accomplish these changes, and that's what we live on now. Alaska is a young state, and our food production, our processing capacity is in its infancy. It's really hard to comply with all the federal rules that are necessary, and so it's important that as we look at policy, that we don't make that even more difficult. It's difficult enough to jump on this moving train that everybody else has had time to get used to and try and produce in accordance with all these new rules and requirements without a bunch of policies that challenge that even further. Policies, for example, like a sin tax for eating meat. Yeah, you're going to eat meat, then we're going to charge you for it. How much gas? Charging a tax on how much gas your cows pass, or or restrictions on the ability to raise livestock on your own farm. Some of these sound ridiculous, and yet they are real, and they are current bills that are being discussed. And we take a lot of time, takes a lot of time to fight these things. We ought to be back here raising your food, and we're down here fighting for existence. And so anyway, I just want to kind of close this section that you can rely on Alaska Farm Bureau for accurate policy for agriculture. We will not be presenting you with our personal opinions as policy recommendations for agriculture. We discuss these policies as a group. We vote on them. And when we, if you have questions and you want to know how does this affect Alaskan agriculture, you call the Alaska Farm Bureau. Call Amy or myself, and that information will be based on policy, and it'll be based on sound discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll take back up here. So since Bryce was starting to talk about policy, you know, and working together to form good policy, kind of talk about some other partnerships for a little bit. And one thing, Arthur talked about it in his presentation, but the Division of Ag and the Kenai Soil and Water Conservation District and the Farm Bureau, we all kind of got together to think of something fun to do to promote our farmers and, you know, buying local. So we came up with the $5 a week Alaska Grown Challenge, and it's $5 per person per week. And, you know, you can see it has $188 million impact if everyone spends $5 a week. So this was kind of a fun way to educate people on what we produce seasonally, year-round, where you can find it, and the impact of just a small amount that you could have on the local economy. And then the Division of Ag kind of took it the next step, and that's kind of what Arthur talked about. They got the retailers involved, and the retailers started pushing the $5 challenge this summer. And it was pretty fun to see some of the displays that were in the stores, like the Palmer store that won. So, you know, doing things like this, we can work together to really promote our agriculture industry. And then getting a little bit back to partnering on policy, being able to work with the legislators or the administration can help us set a policy that will expand these opportunities. Educating consumers with the $5 challenge is great, and it will help build awareness that we do have agriculture. I still have people asking me, do we have farms in Alaska? So the $5 challenge has been great educating that way, and now we need to, you know, work with the legislators and administrators and policymakers so we can actually build our farming and ranching industry. And as Bryce mentioned earlier, we haven't had the time to grow like other states have had. And having policies based on those large, you know, the farms that have been in existence doesn't necessarily work up here in Alaska, especially with our small and beginning farmers. But when we get together and have proposals like House Bill 217, which I know you've been discussing, these are ways that can help our smaller farmers and the cottage food industry access markets easier and allow the consumers more options. So whether we're looking at how to get affordable and suitable lands, and in your slides I give you some examples, there's obviously lots more policies. But whether we're looking at how to get lands into farmers' hands, you know, rethinking what best use of state lands is, or over-regulating, like Bryce was talking about, the sin tax on meat consumption. You know, luckily that hasn't passed, but it does get brought up from time to time. And those type of regulations are an undue burden on our farmers, or the excessive taxes that we sometimes have to deal with. You know, if we have good policy in place, Alaskans as a whole will benefit from our farmers and ranchers being successful. Now, how these policies are written is really important. I know in House Bill 217, the sale of raw milk is an issue that's come up. And this is an example of a policy that could open the door for several producers It could open the market for having more farms in the state. But how those policies are actually written takes some discussion, because there's two sides to the story. And instead of both the sides fighting it out, getting together, forming a working group or something to discuss the best way to write this policy that will give our farmers the best chance of success. Another policy issue that the Farm Bureau has discussed is the liability for agritourism. This is a growing sector of agriculture. Our farmers are inviting members of the public onto their farms, whether it's a B&B, UPIC farms, bringing schools in just for educational purposes. This is opening up our farmers to liability, which in turn increases cost of insurance. So if we could work together to find a way to add some securities on this sector of our agriculture business, it would help, help our farmers be more successful, which gets more food on our plate and more local dollars in our economies. As Bryce mentioned, at our annual meeting in November each year, our Farm Bureau members discuss policy. We look at legislation, and it's a great place for, if the legislators wanted to come and join us, it's a great place to talk about potential legislation each year and get feedback from farmers. And with that, we're open to questions. We also have several of our Farm Bureau members here in the audience. If there's time, I know we got a little bit of a late start today, but.
Thank you so much. A couple things I want to say. The agritourism issue was brought to our attention after the amendment deadline, but we did have an amendment prepared for that. So we're going to pass that around for folks' consideration and see if that's something folks think is appropriate to include in 217 before that leaves our committee. So that's one item. We do have another individual for a presentation, so I want to make sure we do have time for that. So Susie, if she's online still, and then because we have House Bill 217 notice for public testimony, we have two people signed up for that. So want to just, in our remaining 20, 25 minutes, be able to do all those things. So that probably means we have maybe 2 or 3 minutes if that would be appropriate. We could have you introduce the folks that are here with you with the Farm Bureau.
Yes, and so we could introduce. We do have several FFA students, which were introduced earlier. And then we have Rita Jo Schultz from the Kenai Peninsula. She's one of the founding peony growers in the state. Dave Carpenter from the peninsula as well. He is a peony grower. And hopefully everyone will have a chance to say hi tomorrow while we're making our way around. Carol Henley, I know she has peonies, but also she's a great baby. Wayne Floyd from the peninsula, he's another peony grower, and I believe also some vegetable. They also grow produce. We have John Anderson in the back. He is up in the interior in Fairbanks area, and they have livestock, and his wife Michaela, who some of you may know her. She works here in the Capitol building. And then Fritz Wozniak from up in Fairbanks as well, and he's livestock, and also they have one of the three USDA slaughter facilities in the state.
Matt Bates.
Oh, and Matt Bates, and I missed Matt Bates. He is from Delta area, does a little bit of everything. Yeah. Livestock, produce.
Very cool.
So we have a nice selection around the state as well as different sectors of what they grow.
Excellent. Thank you for those introductions. Any comments? I think at least a couple people have constituents among those people.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to make any comments.
I just had a really quick question.
Sure.
We talk about the $5 a week challenge all the time, and we hear a lot about that. And we know what the target is, the $188 million. Do we have any rough estimate of where we actually have landed since we started on an annual basis? I mean, have we hit the $188 million, or are we doing $100 million, or $40 million, or $160 million? Do we have any idea?
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, some of you guys haven't been buying this thing.
$5 a week, every family. So who's not doing it? No, we haven't hit the 188 million.
Okay.
Arthur, do you have any numbers?
I think the USDA census may be a little bit helpful. It's coming out, you know, 2017.
Okay.
No, there's.
And just.
So we can get an early start for next year.
Yeah, it would be nice to know. You have these resource committee members here that I think would like to help promote that at some point in time on their own. So if we have a number, we could probably really, really get rolling on it. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Thank you so much for the presentation today and for all of the great work that you do. And thank you to the other Farm Bureau members, board members who have traveled to Juneau to be here and educate us. And thank you for the work that you're doing. So I hope everyone will be at the reception tomorrow night, if not sooner, where people will get a chance to talk with you more about the work you're doing every day and how, you know, make sure we know what we can do to support that. Our next presenter is Susie Crosby from Cottonwood Creek Farm, and she's going to be on the phone. And I think Susie's going to talk a little bit about the raw milk idea. And I will say that because we haven't passed the bill out of the committee right now, is still a possibility. And that, as Ms. Seitz mentioned, at the Farm Bureau annual meetings, that's where ideas are generated about policy. So when I attended the Farm Bureau annual meeting in Fairbanks in the fall of 2016, is where farmers talked to me about the idea of being able to expand raw milk sales. So this idea was generated by farmers, and I know we've had a few callers from the previous public testimony interested in this issue, and so we haven't given up on this issue, and so we're going to hear more about this and continue that conversation with the recommendation of Ms. Seitz for a working group, and we've talked a little bit about that, to have folks that are interested in that come together and work on that and figure out how we can craft a policy that's going to work for Alaska. So with that introduction, Ms. Crosby, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Could you please state your name for the record and affiliation, and then please go ahead and go forward, and we have probably about 10, 15 minutes for your presentation.
Okay. This is Susie Crosby. I'm with Cottonwood Creek Farm in the Matsu Valley, and we are a goat farm. We do herd share. We got our first goats in 2001 and 2, and by 2003 we had more milk than our family could handle. And I was approached through the Weston A. Price Foundation saying that they had somebody that was interested in doing herd share with us. And that was our very first herd share customer. And it has grown since that time to where we now have several dozen regular herd share customers who, in accordance with Alaska state law, we don't sell raw milk per se. What we do is sell people who are interested in consuming the raw milk a share of our herd, and then in accordance with the Alaska state law, they are able to then, since they're partial owners of a herd of goats, they're able to drink a share of the milk and pay for a share of the expenses. So it's some tedious terminology, but it does keep it within the legal definition of herd share. Reasons why people have come to us seeking raw milk: a lot of people consider that raw milk is nature's perfect food. There's a lot of what we now call locavores. Those are people that like to eat local as much as possible. They want to shorten the food chain. They'd like to know the farmer, be able to visit the farm. We've been approached by a lot of people with digestive issues, either themselves or their children. We've had three or four moms that have told us unequivocally that they credit that raw milk with saving their child's life when nothing else was digestible for their child. We don't do any real advertising. It's strictly word of mouth, but our phone rings with a new interested party for herd share almost every week. And people do frequently ask us for additional products. So I have to explain to them that at this time in Alaska, herd share is legal for fluid milk only, and the membership is a requirement. And it is interesting to me that raw milk is possibly one of the most regulated substances in the entire United States. And in Alaska, even, you know, the irony is not lost here that marijuana is now legal and yet raw milk is not. So it's exciting to see food freedom bills being introduced and enacted across the country. Wyoming has been a leader in this area. And the state of Maine, we visited in Maine a couple of years ago, and they have a very relaxed raw milk law. There's a $25 license required, and then at that point, the raw milk producer can also make cheese, yogurt, other products, and sell them at a farm stand on their property to anyone who wishes to purchase. I think, you know, there's always going to be, raw milk is going to always be a very polarizing issue. There will always be people who will say it's the greatest food on earth, and there will be people who say, nope, it's going to kill you. But all that aside, that debate aside, I think the bigger issue is food freedom, and that people should have the right to choose the foods that they eat and consume. And food security, as you've heard us from other presenters, how little of our food is grown in Alaska, and how great it would be if the state of Alaska would be more encouraging to small farmers and small producers who are able to produce some of that food and keep it out of the, you know, out of the whole grocery store and transportation chain, and be able to supply that to friends and neighbors. Does anyone have any questions at this point?
They do, and I'm just going to add in a little bit for context here. Thank you, Ms. Crosby. As she was stating, you know, we have the herd share opportunity, but what we would do possibly through legislation is expand that opportunity to be more like the Maine example, so that they could have individual containers for sale, or, you know, be able to make other products. And I will just say, when you're at Fred Meyer next time, if you look in the cheese section, you know, you'll see that there's raw milk cheese for sale. Of course, not, you know, a product that's originating in Alaska at this time, but, you know, that's just an example of one of the products we might be able to have if we, you know, enabled this opportunity. And where the Farm Bureau at the annual meeting this fall did support expanding raw milk sales, and the caveat was to figure out a way to do inspection. And so I want to bring that up. And with DEC, one of the concerns they had was if there's some kind of illness situation, you know, how would they contact customers? And so the idea of, you know, maintaining a customer database, which I bet, and Ms. Crosby, if you want to add to this, you know, I bet everyone's doing, just for purposes of good relationships with the people who are buying from you, and that type of thing. And so those are two things that are why we're going to continue the conversation to kind of, you know, figure out how those things would be accomplished. To, you know, address some of those concerns, and I'm hopeful that we will be able to do that. So I just wanted to give that little bit of context. Ms. Crosby, I don't know if you want to add anything to that before Representative Rauscher has a question for you.
Sure, go ahead with the question.
Okay, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Crosby, I guess I'm going to let my ignorance shine here, and I guess everybody in the room may know the answer but me. But you've talked about herd share, and I was wondering what exactly is involved there, the cost, how are those shared, the product, how is it divided, and the profit divided in a herd share situation like yours?
Okay, so the herd share setup, basically it is a $40 one-time membership fee for people that would like to become part of our herd share, and then we have a several-page agreement that explains all the particulars, and the members of the herd share are their membership strictly allows them to pay a monthly maintenance fee for a share of the milk that is produced from the herd, but it does not give them rights as to the profitability of the herd. They don't have any say in what happens to the kids that are born every year, or animals that are, you know, bought or sold.
Any follow-up?
Did that answer your question?
I'm not sure. I guess I'm still a little foggy on what's the membership that they now possess?
The $40 membership represents purchasing approximately a 10% share of a goat in the herd. But that is for a share of the milk that that goat produces, because that is what the average herd share member is interested in. If people are interested in meat or other products, that's not really part of part of the definition or intent of herd share. Herd share, by definition, relates to the accessibility for acquiring fluid milk from the consumer to the produced and offered to the consumer.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And Ms. Crosby, can you just talk about, you know, what would be different, for example, is under a system where you could have an individual, you know, quantity, you know, an individual can say, okay, I want to buy a pint, I want to buy a quart, I want to buy a gallon. You know, under a herd share, it's you're not deciding which quantity is best for you based on your consumption. Under a herd share, you know, you're however many are in the herd, you're dividing up the available quantity. Do you want to comment on that a little bit? I don't know if that gets to part of Representative Rauscher's question.
It is. Thank you.
Yeah. If a person is interested, the two most typical amounts that people are interested in on a weekly basis are either a half a gallon or a gallon per week. So they have a set day, scheduled pickup day, and the people that are getting a half a gallon a week are going to pay a $42 a month flat rate for that. The people that are getting a gallon a week are going to be paying a $75 a month flat rate herd share maintenance fee and picking up that amount of milk.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and I really appreciate your explanations. Thank you, and your help, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Crosby? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Crosby. This is absolutely fascinating. I think you just answered my question. The $40 membership is a 10% share of a goat in the herd for its milk. And then the...
That's correct.
Is the $42 a month for half a gallon per week or the $75 per month for a gallon per week in addition to that $40 membership?
Yes, the $40 membership is a one-time buy-in to make you an official herd share member. And then there's an ongoing, because the goats have an ongoing need for feed, which is not cheap, those herd share monthly maintenance fees pay for the goats' care and feeding.
Okay. And I think I do have a question about lactose intolerance, but I think I'll ask you on your Facebook page because we're running out of time.
Sure.
Here. Thank you.
Yeah, feel free. We do, a lot of the people that come to us for goat milk are seeking goat milk due to their lactose intolerance, which part of the intolerance that people have for grocery store milk is the fact that pasteurization strips out a lot of the enzymes and including the digestive enzymes that are present in raw milk. So we have a number of herd share customers who are with us because it is the milk that they can digest, they or their children.
Great. Thank you very much.
And I guess just my final comment on that is, you know, and what you can see is that perhaps if you're a customer who, you know, wants less of a quantity than that, for example, right, the limitation now is that you don't have as much customer choice as we might have under another program where, you know, they could make multiple different quantities available and people could choose based on their family consumption or individual consumption what they would need. This issue will come back again, and we really look forward to working with you on that, Ms. Crosby, and thank you for being available today to share that information to give us a better understanding of how it works.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
In our last remaining minutes, we have two individuals. I'm going to go back to the public testimony on House Bill 217. We had kept that open during our last meeting, so I'm going to go to Nicole Ervalio from Homer. If you are still available, could you please put yourself on the record and have just about a minute and a half or 2 minutes to testify on House Bill 217?
Hi, my name is Nicole Ervalio. I'm a resident of Homer, and I am speaking in support of House Bill 217. I think this bill makes sense for both Alaska's economy and for those of us living in the many regions of the state where food production is expanding every year. I prefer to buy locally produced foods every chance I get. I get my shopping done at farmers markets whenever I can. I am thrilled that Alaska-raised beef and pork and pasta made in Sterling are available at my local grocery store, and I want more. There is such interest in expanding the offerings and availability of Alaska-grown, locally made, and cottage foods. People from all walks in our communities are really getting behind the movement to source more and more of our foods from our northern terroir rather than from a shipping container. House Bill 217 helps us consumers who want to eat food made right here, often as fresh as it gets, and spend our dollars supporting those individuals in our communities who make the nice things for us to buy instead of handing the money over to mass producers from outside. Since we can't all make it to farmers markets on the days and times they're open, and since there's not enough booth space to accommodate all of the producers whose numbers are growing year by year, more outlets for our budding pool of producers is warranted. I am very excited that there are online outlets like the Kenai Peninsula Food Hub being developed in our communities so that people can get online and see what's available from local producers, local foods craftsmen, and buy things from them. And through this online sales tool, upstart businesses and small-scale operations have the chance to get their products out there and for us consumers to fall in love with it. I want to buy jams and pickles and other handcrafted value-added cottage foods from the local innovators making them. And I want my dollars to circulate right here in my local economy. So these online markets do not prevent consumers like me from asking questions to the producers about their products or reduce their accountability for food safety. Rather, the online forum can provide contact information, maintains an electronic record of transactions, and producers can actually provide potentially more information about their products to more consumers using their online space. So HB 217 enables this online base for local producer-to-consumer transactions, and I'm happy that the bill also includes provisions for more locally sourced food to go to our school and other state-sponsored agencies. I think that's fantastic. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your testimony today. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. And then we're going to go to George Pierce from Kasiloff, if George is available.
Yes. Thank you for taking my testimony. I support 217. This should be a no-brainer. We need to encourage growing our own and support agriculture and dairy products. The Alaskans should grow their own. Moms and pops, give them incentives to help. In an emergency, we may not get food. So grow our own and stop depending on corporations and others. Make it easy to access land for gardening, support dairy and game farmers all over our, all of our fruit and vegetables brought in, and they are not ripe. They don't have any, they don't have the sugars and nutritional value. We need fresh, ripe food, not unripe food. It tastes like cardboard. Grow Alaska is best. Hydro tunnels on the Kenai Peninsula are doing very well in gardening. There is a state in the Midwest that have game farms, and they give deer to help feed the food bank for the poor and elderly. It would be nice to stop depending on the lower 48. Give land to farmers and help them out. We give land away all over this state. We should give land to help support farmers of all kinds for fresh, healthy food. Buy local and cut out the footprint from the lower 48. And thanks for taking my testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Pierce. You get the last word in public testimony on House Bill 217. I'm going to close public testimony. And because of the late start, we won't have time to bring the bill back before you today, and we'll do that in the next meeting, I hope. And but I did just pass out an amendment. As Ms. Seitz talked about in her testimony, there's this growing interest in the agritourism business, and this particular amendment was brought, again, after the bill, the amendment deadline, so want to make sure we all are following the same deadline. But because we have time now with keeping the bill, you know, in before us today, want to pass that out for your consideration. We'll check back in with offices. If this is something that folks can support when we bring back up the bill, then we'll incorporate this amendment into it and before we pass it out of committee, I hope. But so this will be for your consideration. And if you look at it, basically what it does is it adds the farm tours to the lists of sports and recreational activities to limit the liability for those folks visiting. So we will have the bill back before us, I hope, on Friday. Please take a look at that amendment. We'll circle back. And then, of course, it's great that you have these folks in town who hopefully can answer some questions about why that might be helpful and in terms of what's happening on the farms. So again, thank you so much to our presenters today. Thank you to Director Keyes for your enthusiasm and passion, and also to Mr. Wrigley and Ms. Seitz. Similarly, it's so wonderful to have you all doing the great work you are every day. And so with that, we will adjourn today at 3:01 p.m.